So when people ask you, when they come up to you and they don't know who you are and you're in an elevator, what do you tell them you do?
I usually tell them I sell tomatoes.
And then they say, really? You must be a really good tomato salesman? Or what's the response?
Well, they say, how can you make money selling tomatoes? So you got to sell a lot of tomatoes.
Bob Parsons, you've changed the landscape of golf, but among other things, what do you think, when you look at everything you've done, what is the most important thing you've accomplished at this point in your life?
The most important thing I've ever accomplished is I'm a United States Marine.
There you go.
I joined the Marine Corps when I was 17. To say I was a terrible student is giving me more credit than I deserve. They turned that around completely. I did a combat tour in Vietnam and have some tremendous brothers to this day because of that, friendships that are just transcend everything you usually know. When I went to college, I graduated magna cum laude. I've never done that without the Marine Corps. So everything I've ever accomplished, I owe it to the Marine Corps. So to me, my first and biggest accomplishment, I'm a United States Marine.
Yeah. I wish I could say the same thing. I just sort of dropped out of high school and, learned a lot outside the Marine Corps. But I have watched Band of Brothers obsessively. Have you seen this?
Band of Brothers? Yeah, I did.
Yeah? What do you think of that?
Well, I think that was a harrowing experience for anyone that was involved in that. And the friendships you formed during those times are exceptional.
So how did you get into, most famously, you're going to, when people Google you, they're going to see GoDaddy. How did you get involved with that? But really, that's a story that a lot of people have already told. So I guess the question is, or maybe it's more of a general question, right? And when I'm looking at the decisions you've made as far as business, a lot of what I see is you had a problem and you wanted to solve it, and then you started a business based around that. Can you talk about that in general as far as the course of all your endeavors?
Yeah, that's pretty much been the case, with the exception that I became a computer hobbyist back in 1975. And that was like being involved in the automobile business at the turn of the previous century. And so the timing couldn't have been better. Back then, everything was sold on floppy disks in plastic bags. There was really no significant companies. 16K of RAM was a lot. So it was far different times, but I became a hobbyist then through a fluke. And what the fluke was is I was working as an accountant for a company in Baltimore, and my job was I would fly to different companies and just summarize their books, and they would decide if they wanted to buy them or not. Well, I was out on this company deal in Redwood City, California, and I finished up 12 hours before my flight was to leave. So I had 12 hours to burn. So I found my way onto Stanford campus and went into the bookstore, and I bought a book that dealt with how to program in the basic computer language. Very simple, simple book. And I read that during the time I had to spare, or the 12 hours. And on the flight back, I wrote my first program, which was how to discount a loan, come up with the interest rate, which was very difficult to do back then. I did that. And when I got back there, I was fortunate enough that the company I worked for was owned by one of the first computer companies, a company called Control Data. And in our office, we had this dumb computer terminal. Back then, there was no CRTs or displays or anything like that, and looked like a teletype machine. But anyhow, it understood the basic language, and I learned how to program from getting that program to work, and then I taught myself from there, and I became more proficient. And then I learned, I went from basic to programming in Pascal, and I bought one of the first Apples that came out. And then when the first IBM came out in 80, shortly thereafter, I sold my 2E and I bought an IBM PC. And then I started my first company in my basement in 1984, because what I did was, since I was an accountant and I was a CPA, again, passed that exam the first time, never would have done it without the Marine Corps. And I wrote a program that would do the family budget and so forth. And I decided in 1984 to start selling it out of my basement. I had $15,000 at the time, which was all the money I had in the world. I was like a young guy walking into jail for the first time. I lost that immediately. And then I continued to work on the software, continued to work on it. And the next year from my real job, I got a $25,000 bonus, where I had $25,000. Part of it was a bonus from my real job. Part of it was what from my tax loss at a $15,000. Part of it was what I was able to save and get credit cards. But anyhow, I dropped the price of my software from, initially it was like $129. I dropped it to $99 and to $69 and to $49. Lost everything still. The next year, I continued to work on my software. And I mean, I worked on it every moment because my dream was to have something special, you know, that would make a difference. And the following year, I didn't have much money. And I had a magazine call me, and they said, we will sell you, this is how crazy things were back then, that we will sell you the outside front cover. You know, like being on the cover of Rolling Stone, only this was called the Computer Bargain Line in Fort Dodge, Iowa. They said, the cover of our magazine sells for like $16,000. We will sell it to you for $5,000 if you can get us creative in 2 days. And so I said, I'll buy it. I didn't have any money, but what I did have back then is I had good credit because I always paid my bills. Everybody thought I had money. So I got my first ad done. I dropped the price of my software to $16, to $12. And the product, I called it Money Counts. And I said, money counts, but it only costs $12. And back then, software was copy protected. It was, you couldn't make a certain number of backups. Some of it was, you had to have special codes. Some, and it said, you know, you can't let other people use it. And I said, it's not copy protected. Make as many backups as you want. Give it to all your friends. Do anything you want. Just send me $12. And that had made money, and the company was born.
So it sounds like the biggest part of that success right there is the revolutionary idea of, you know, not only is it a low price, but you can do whatever you want once you've paid it. Is that true?
Well, there you go. That's what I had to do then.
How does that, I guess we need to get into golf. So how does that thinking different come into golf? And your, you know, now indelible mark on the game.
Well, you know, we're certainly doing a different approach. You know, back then I was selling electrical impulses, which basically cost me nothing other than my sweat effort, right? And I had no inventory. As a matter of fact, I had as much inventory as I needed because I was just copying electronic impulses onto a disc and sending them out. It cost me $1, you know, for the 12. Now what we're doing is we're on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. We're still working hard to do the job right, like it's never been done before. But in doing so, we're making an incredible investment, whereas I didn't back then, at least not in comparison to what's happening now. I mean, for right now, you know, our engineers are, you know, they're under no time constraints. They're under no cost constraints. The money that we spend to make our clubs, people would be stunned. On many of our irons, we pay to cost us to make the physical iron what our competitors sell theirs for. All right? But we believe that shows and it translates into the performance of the product.
Sure. Do you, I had a question that's in my tongue. When you, I had a great question, Bob. I can't remember what it was. It was, you were talking about, this might be the first podcast I need to edit. I usually don't edit the podcast, Bob.
Well, I'm fine if you edit.
I was going to say that this is unusual. You got me speechless. Do you have a question for me?
Yeah, what's the question you forgot?
There you go. Let's talk about motorcycles. You like bikes?
Yeah, I do. I have. I tend to do things I enjoy doing. My father told me when I started my first business, he said, you should always do what you love, because when you love something, it tells you all its secrets. And to me, there's never been a thing that I've ever done to make money. I've done things that I like to do. And, you know, while, trust me, I'm very happy to make money, and I try to make the decisions that help that. But first and foremost, the thing that I'm interested in is doing the job better than anybody else could do the job. At least that's the goal.
Okay, I remember my question. It was, you seem like the type of person to not really be interested in advice, but I'm curious to know, when you were exploring the idea of creating a golf business, I imagine a lot of people said it was a bad idea. Is that true?
Everybody said it was a bad idea. Nobody said, hey, Bob, good choice. You know, I had people say, you know, so-and-so, and I cannot name names, you know, was involved, you know, made a run at the golf business, and, you know, they have all these smart people, this, that, and the other thing. And they lost their shirt. And now I can't think of a worse business to be in, and it's down, and people are, you know, not playing golf the way they were. And I thought it sounded like a marvelous time. So, you know, I just said, okay, well, maybe you guys are right. I said, but then maybe you're not. So sometimes when people think you're crazy, it's a pretty good sign.
How do you make that decision, right? I mean, because it sounds like it's not strictly a business decision. Like, it sounds like you're going off of a gut feeling, and it seems like that's probably a trait that a lot of very successful entrepreneurs have. Is that true?
Yeah, well, that's pretty much the way I've made every decision. I'm not much of a planner, or, you know, if you ask me what the 5-year plan is, we'd have to talk in generalities, as opposed to, well, these are the numbers and this is the return and this is my exit strategy. I even share my exit strategy. My exit strategy is cremation. You know, when that happens, I'll be done.
So, I mean, what's the deal with Bob Parsons? Is he just really, really, really lucky?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think, make no mistake, luck has something to do with it. But where the skill comes in is the spot when the luck happens, and take advantage of it. What I do is I persevere, and I when I have something that I'm working on, I do. You know, I don't get discouraged. I wake up every morning like I'm going to batting practice, and I keep swinging at it. And sometimes, like, for example, when GoDaddy got going, and when Parsons Technology, which was the business I talked about earlier, that got going, it took me 3 years of swinging without hitting a pitch before anything really happened. But I don't discourage easy.
Is that true? 3 years? That would be hard for a lot of people to continue.
Well, you know, I guess there's people that would hang on for 10 or 20 or for the rest of their lives. But if you have a vision and you can see it, and you just got to find the right way to do it, well, there you go. You know, the one thing I'll say, I know of no successful business people who haven't been on their ass a time or two. And so being successful in business with what we know, which is very little, is you learn by making mistakes and learning. Instead of learning what to do, you learn what not to do. And so I was pretty good at learning what not to do. I mean, I spent a lot of time learning what not to do.
Is there a specific training or experience in the Marines that really drilled home the idea of, well, I can't remember the word you used, but it's basically dedication?
Well, I would say you can summarize it in one word, which is discipline. And discipline is having the stamina to see your responsibilities through, and the realization that, you know, you're not the only one that depends on that. You know, it impacts other people, particularly in a military or combat situation. You know, the discipline, what I learned from them, I mean, I was a pretty unfocused lad when I went into the military, and I was a completely different guy when I came out. And I mean, I, you know, knew you're supposed to get up a certain time. Up I was. You needed to do this. I did it. Didn't have to be comfortable. If I had to carry a 17-pound box of machine gun ammo 5 miles where you feel like your arm's coming out of your socket, you just keep doing it because you got the discipline to do it. You know, people are counting on you to do it.
So you're saying, I've never heard it put that way, but you're saying discipline is basically a selfless act.
Yeah, well, you know, it is selfless, and it's a realization that responsibility means something. I mean, you know, they taught me discipline. They taught me responsibility. They taught me pride. They taught me pretty clean is dirty.
Whoa.
Those sorts of things. That's the Marine Corps.
Pretty clean is dirty.
Yeah.
What's your favorite part about golf?
I'm not sure I understand.
Golf? What's your favorite part about it?
What's my favorite part about it? I like getting out and playing. I'm a bit of a, you know, I don't gamble at all except on the golf course. My friends and I play a game called Sweat, which we all just conjured up over the years. It's the perfect gambling game, and I absolutely love doing that.
What can you describe the general rules to Sweat?
Absolutely. Well, here's the way it is. Sweat is played for points, and when you first tee off, anybody can double the bet, which is called a roll, at any time. So someone could roll me, and after they roll me, I'll either take it or I don't. If I don't take the bet, whatever the point was worth, that's conceded. Okay, so we play 100 a point. And let's say I do take the bet, then the bet goes from, it doubles, it goes to $200 a point. Now, the kicker in Sweat is when you roll somebody and they take the bet, a half stroke goes with it.
Oh.
And that changes everything. And so anyhow, this continues until, I mean, you can roll and, you know, double the bet back and forth as often as you want.
So a hole can end up at 1,000.
Oh, yeah. I've seen them at 5,000. But anyhow, that's under different circumstances. And I don't do that all the time. But when I do, it's memorable. Hey, but anyhow, so, you know, as it doubles and goes back and forth and the strokes come and go away, it continues until a ball is in the hole. So you could be on a green and still be doubling the bet back and forth or so forth in this game. And winning with a birdie doubles the bet. Winning with an eagle quads the bet. And an ace is 10x. So that's the basics. There's a lot of nuances to it.
Have you ever seen an ace within the confines of the Sweat game?
Absolutely.
Really?
I got paid both times.
Really?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
And I didn't make the ace. I made the ace once.
Okay.
And my buddy made the ace another time.
And how many hole-in-ones do you have on your career?
Two.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's more than most.
Well, you know what? More than I ever thought I'd have.
When did you get introduced to the game of golf? It doesn't sound like you grew up with it, or did you?
You know, I didn't. My father was a scratch golfer.
Okay.
And I grew up in Baltimore, and East Baltimore, and there's a golf course there called Clifton Park. And I think Clifton Park is one of those golf courses where today one of the hazards is getting robbed and mugged. I mean, it's kind of a tough place, you know. So, but anyhow, that's where I grew up. And my father used to go over there all the time and hit balls on the range. And he'd take me and my brother. And we were little guys. And every once in a while, we would we'd get to swing a club, or he'd show us the grip. But mostly we chased rabbits. I didn't pick the game up seriously until I was in my 30s.
Okay.
And when I was in my 30s is when I was with Parsons Technology. And there was a number of guys I worked with, and we all took the game up at the same time. And then we all got better at the same time. And, you know, it started where we'd take a half a day off on Wednesday afternoon. And then we found a resort that we liked to go to. So we'd take a half a day off on Wednesday. We would be on the tee the first light of the morning, you know, play another 18, and then zoom back. And then it went from, you know, Wednesday and Thursday morning to Wednesday and Thursday morning and Saturday and Sunday and golf trips. And you know how it goes.
Yeah. And so how do you come up with the title, PXG?
What about the title?
How did you come up with the name of the company, PXG?
Well, PXG.com was one of the three-letter names that was available. And, you know, there was a number of them, and PXG, my first name happens to be Parsons. We were going to be in the golf business, and that was just a matter of figuring out what the X was. So we went with Extreme.
I mean, that's marketing right there.
There you go.
That's pretty smart.
Well, that's how it happened.
That's great. I mean, that's a totally satisfactory answer. But you came at it with a need, right, that you were seeking to fulfill. What was that?
Well, you know, what I noticed, see, I also own a golf club called Scottsdale National. And I got to meet a number of very successful businessmen and women. And their game is very important to them. And, you know, I got to think that, you know, some of those guys, you know, if you give them 15 yards when they're drive, they paint themselves blue, right? I mean, it just didn't matter, right? You know, so, you know, they pay anything, whatever, 15 yards, right? So I got to thinking about, maybe there was something I could do. Now, there's more of a backstory. I always bought a lot of golf clubs. Unlike buddies of mine, I never got fancy cars. I never, you know, never gambled into casinos or off the golf course. You know, I didn't do any. I drove Dodges and Chevys. So what happened was I would buy golf clubs when they came out. You know, I would sometimes, I would have a bad day, and I'd be in Florida, and a buddy of mine was a club dealer in Iowa, and I'd call him and say, yeah, I had a really bad day. He says, I got some new clubs you got to try. He'd FedEx them that day. I'd walk out on the tee the next day, and there wouldn't be one club in my bag that was the same. So I got to the point where I would try most new things and would try to understand why they did what they did and all that. I studied ballistics. I studied aerodynamics, a little bit of metallurgy. And I mean, just enough to be dangerous. And I got to understand what worked and what didn't. And most things were hype. So, you know, I met my buddy Mike Nicolette, and we were talking one day, and I asked him, I said, Mike, why don't, and by the way, before I preface this, I want to say that I think Ping is one of my far better competitors. I think the world did a company. Okay, so this is no knock on Ping.
Well, their irons are quite similar right now.
No, they're not.
on the of every other competitor on the market, they're the most similar.
I don't think they are, no.
Really?
No. So you and I are going to have to knock heads on that, brother.
Well, I'm curious to know what the answer is to that, actually.
Okay, to what?
I was under the impression that the i500s are, of all of the current competitive irons, they are using the most similar technology. But I really know much less than you about that. So.
Well, I don't believe so.
Okay.
I'll just say that that's the answer that I have, and I believe that they have a very different look. It's a very different product.
Yeah. Yeah, not saying that they are comparable, merely saying that they are attempting to be similar.
Well, you know, I really have no comment on that because I know what you're doing, and I'm just going to have to say we're going to have to agree to disagree.
It's fair enough.
All right.
What you were saying about Ping, though.
Okay, so anyhow, I said, why don't companies get a lot better from year to year? The thing he said to me was, he said, because, you know, we're under cost constraints, we got to meet certain price points, we have certain delivery dates we have to meet, got time constraints, so our hands are tied in a lot of ways, all right? So he says, so some of the things that we'd like to do, we can't do. And I talked to him and I said, suppose I had a situation where I had a company where the engineers had no cost constraints, pay, you know, whatever you want, right? As long as it made sense and there was a performance return and you had as much time as you wanted and you could take all the time in the world if you wanted to develop it, but your only constraint was performance, right? And that's it. And he said, you know, I think it would make a difference. So, he contacted me a while later, said he'd like to join me. And then another fellow there did, Brad Schweikert, and I went and talked to my right-hand guy, who is now the chief operating officer, Steve Gabe. I said, Steve, looks like we're in a golf business. God help us.
What do you think, what has been the most surprising part of having your own golf business now?
Well, I'm going to say that, you know, my father told me, he used to say, you know, it's always going to seem to you like the other guy's business is easier. He says, don't you ever believe it. Now, I will tell you that I believe all businesses are difficult. Along those lines, I will tell you that I think the golf business is especially difficult. You got to really be on your toes to be successful in this business. And it is a matter of over-delivering, things being what you say, panache of the brand, knowledge, the employee base, all those things. But we're successful in this business. I'm going to be a very happy man.
What do you say to, you know, there's all these people talking about how golf being in trouble or whatever, you know, golf business, XYZ. I mean, are you concerned with that?
No, I'm not concerned with that at all. And I'll tell you why. I think the golf consumers in the country as a big whole are they constrain and expand, you know, as time goes by. And what happens, though, I think when you lose golfers, like has happened over the past number of years, I think it's went the other way the past year a little bit, is the guys that are on the fringe. They really don't play that much, that don't spend much money, you know, or family men where they can't, you know, they can't really get away and they got commitments and all that. I think that's the part. the part that I catered to, which are the people who now have the time to play and have the earnings where they can pay to play, I don't think that's changed ever.
Have you incorporated golf much into your world travels?
You know, as much as I could. As much as I could, I was able to play golf year before last in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and then not too long ago, Hong Kong and Cambodia.
Cambodia, was that, that's near, was going to Cambodia strange as a Vietnam vet?
Going to Vietnam was strange as a Vietnam vet. I went to Vietnam for the first time, returned in November before last, and I was asked to go there to keynote an international golf conference. And at first they wanted to have the conference in October, and I said, I can't do it in October. And they said, well, we'll move it. And I said, really? And then they said, I said, I will do it in November on one condition. I don't want to be around anything that has to do with the war. And they said, done. And so I was a little apprehensive going over there. And when I got there, I fell in love with it all over again. I have never felt so good about being anywhere in my life as I was in Da Nang and Vietnam and that whole area where I served around there. Didn't recognize a thing because everything progressed so long, and it's been almost 47 years since I was there. 49, almost 50.
Wow.
Almost 50 years, yeah. So you know, I just said, you know, I just couldn't believe it. So I told my wife, as much as I love her, I said, if I ever get cut from the team, I might move to Vietnam.
It isn't. We had the chance to go to Thailand. Golf took us to Thailand, and I remember, you know, well, first of all, I was surprised that Thailand is apparently one of Asia's larger golf destinations. People from Japan and Korea go to Thailand because of the, it's so expensive in their home country to play golf. But I just, I remember being a really wonderful paradise there.
Yeah, oh, it was. You know, I got to play golf in Phuket, Thailand. When I sold parts of technology to Intuit, there was a time when they were changing things over, and they wanted me just out of a way. So they gave me this around-the-world golf trip on the Concorde that took about a month. And I said, sure. And so one of the countries I played in was Thailand.
I feel like going on an around-the-world trip with Bob Parsons on a Concorde would be pretty fun.
I had a blast. What are you talking about? I was a single guy. I was playing golf. You know, it was just a happy-go-lucky time.
We'll take a quick break. All right, everybody. Got a great read for you here. Stay tuned till the end of it because there is a massive deal at the end of this read. Precision Pro Golf, maker of the NX7 series rangefinder, is proud to bring you this spot on the Eric Anders Lang Show. The Eric Anders Lang Show is bringing golf to the masses, which is pretty rad. And Precision Pro is bringing accurate measurements to golfers at an affordable price. Their NX7 series rangefinder was named Best Value Golf Rangefinder by MyGolfSpy.com. You heard that right. Best Value Golf Rangefinder at MyGolfSpy.com. With all the bells and whistles that golfers love, without the bloated price tag that other companies charge, it's the perfect rangefinder to add to your golf bag this year. So right now, Precision Pro is offering $20 off the NX7 series rangefinder. Go to precisionprogolf.com, precisionprogolf.com, and use coupon code ERIC, E-R-I-K, do not spell my name wrong this time, folks, for a free lifetime battery replacement, for $20 off, and then you also get free lifetime battery replacement service. Whoa. Dude, you know how many times my battery dies in my rangefinder where I'm just like, ugh, grind. Give me a battery. They're so expensive. If you can actually take advantage of that, you could eventually get a free rangefinder by the end of the time. Yeah, they're not joking, folks. Lifetime battery replacement services. You can check out the awesome reviews on their website or on Amazon. Amazon, that's what's up. To read what other golfers are saying about Precision Pro Golf rangefinders. Once again, go to precisionprogolf.com and use coupon code ERIK, K as in awesome, for $20 off. Swing with confidence, hit more greens with Precision Pro Golf. All right, folks, you know my favorite golf shoe, don't you? I think you do. It's Three Stripe Life, y'all, and that means Adidas. And so anyway, I just wanted to tell you that when I'm a big fan of the Tour 360, obviously, and they've made a huge update to the Tour 360, and the two letters that it's concerned with are the letters X and T, okay? The Tour 360 XT changes the game, okay? It's lighter, so your feet feel even better after a round. By the way, a light golf shoe is what I'm all about. A heavy, there are some other companies making heavy golf shoes, and I'm just like, by the way, I weigh enough. There's enough going on. I'm carrying a golf bag. I'm carrying my team. Tour XT changes the game. It's lighter, so your feet feel even better after a round, and it still features that Boost, y'all. Do you know where Boost comes from? And Boost is cool because it only comes in black and white. I don't know if you noticed that. And actually, the guy who made Boost like was going to bring it to some other, you know, they were shopping it around, and everyone else said no. Adidas was like, I'll take that Boost, even though it's only black and white. And what did Adidas do with it? They made it awesome. I'm looking at Boost right now on my feet. Boost on my feet. And it has an X-shaped traction system that gives you insane stability. Literally, it's not sane. It's literally crazy. Your feet will literally be like, I'm crazy. Best part, it comes in spikeless. Ooh, that's tight. The first spikeless ever in the history of the Tour 360. Crazy comfortable and perfect for the course. Get your pair at adidas.com. Thank me later. Follow Adidas Golf for all the latest and greatest. That's all true statements right there. Check it out. Go support Adidas because they're a good company, good people. All right, light it. All right, and we are back. How did you find, have you been to Scotland at all? Gone there much for golf?
Have I been to where?
Scotland.
I've been to Scotland years ago when I first started playing golf back during my Parsons Technology days. And I played the Old Course and Glen Eagles and... you must obey the rules in Scotland.
How do you
I think they had some rule where, you know, when you're in, this is like years and years ago, if you were in the lobby after 6 p.m., you must wear a coat and a tie, right? And I was in there half smoked up in a bathing suit, and of course then. I had to go change.
Didn't work out. Didn't work out. Yeah, how does Bob Parsons feel about rules? I feel like you. I mean, it's interesting because your I would expect your marine background would give you one perspective on rules, but at the same time, it seems like your business background is all about not following those rules. How do you? Am I? What's the middle line there?
Well, you know, I do follow a lot of rules. You know, I do things like obey all the laws and. You know, pay my taxes and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, from a business standpoint, what I've been willing to do and one of the keys to our success was to break with tradition and to do things differently than it's been done in the past. And so, you know, if they were like unspoken business rules, yeah, we broke those, but that'd be about it.
Yeah. What, and so do you see, I mean, you know, the golf business in general, how would you describe their relationship to, well, you know, there is a divide between tradition and rules, and golf has a very specific, you know, connection to both of those. How has been your experience of working within that boundary?
Well, you know, first of all, it all depends where you are. Like take Augusta National, who, to me and like many other golfers, I consider that to be sacred ground. And, you know, and they have a number of rules that, you know, where you have to wear a coat to dinner and or maybe a coat and a tie to dinner and you need to be with the member, things like that. But that's Augusta and that is their tradition and I get it. And Augusta without that wouldn't be Augusta. And there's other places like at Lake Pine Valley and Cypress Point and on and on. Now, the club that I own, Scottsdale National, we only have one rule, and that is no member shall ever get in the way of another member's good time. Other than that, do what you want to do, you know, as long as you're not causing someone else a problem. And with us, that's what we're about. I mean, all these other places are old money. We're nouveau riche, baby.
How do you see the difference culturally between old money and new money?
You know, old money, you know, first of all, you know, I say that more in jest. There's a number of people that belong to our club that would be old, you could call them old money, and they're, you couldn't tell them apart from anybody else. But it's just that the places that are looked at, like, you know, with the term old money, like a number of the clubs in the Hamptons and some of the others that I just made, you know, they have that tradition, that old money tradition, and where it's generation after generation of members and that sort of thing. With us, I mean, we're all brand new.
How do you think that, there is like a perspective problem with new people that are coming to golf. Would you agree?
Well, you know, it depends. First of all, you know, on one end, if you're new and you're coming to golf, golf is like sentencing, learning the game is like sentencing somebody to be tortured, right? I mean, we're gonna make you absolutely as crazy and as humbled and embarrassed as we can for 5 years. Sure, I'll do that, right? So people that are just starting the game, I mean, you know, that's one thing. But people that are, you know, that are, well, I guess if you're not starting the game, you're in the game, right? That's changing what people want to do and so forth. I think this year's changing in the USGA's rules. I thought they were excellent. And I really appreciated it. I noticed that the scotch still comes out of them. You know, if you want to take you hit the ball out, you can't find it, you want to take a drop, take two strokes, not one. You know, that's just like the scotch used to, you know, when they catch somebody, a little kid shoplifting, they nail his ear to a pole.
Right? Is that true?
Oh, yeah, until he was able to get his ear off the nail. That kid, you know, I guess it worked, you know, but that's the type of mentality that golf rules are based on.
Right.
Now, the one rule I wanted to see that a divot in the fairway is ground under repair. Take your ball out of it. But, no.
I don't think you're alone.
No.
I think a lot of people feel that way.
But the scotch says, no, sir.
You seem to be pretty comfortable with your success, but I'm curious to know, at what points do you pinch yourself?
I don't ever. I don't think about it that way. I look at my, I'm more comfortable with the mailman and the cop, you know, buddies of mine that are doing that blue collar, that sort of thing. I mean, that's my background. That's who I am. And so, you know, never do I look at and think, God, look what I've accomplished, because, you know, I feel a lot of it has been luck. A lot of it has been just hard work. And if, you know, you start getting caught up in that, you lose sight of what you got to do tomorrow. So all I do is I think about what I got to do. My wife and I, we look at, now more than ever, how much we can help. I mean, we have 14 businesses that we run in Yam Worldwide, one of which is PXG. And a lot of the money that we make, we give away. So we are given to, this year, we will give to charity $1 million every 17 days, I think.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that's what we do. And of everything I do, that's the thing I like the best.
What do people not know about you?
What do people not know about me? Like that putting a tux on me is like putting a saddle on a hog. had to be one of the things. I don't know. I'm just a pretty simple guy. You know, right now I drive all Dodges. I love their brotherhood of muscle. I love the fact that, you know, the Italians are involved in designing American cars. I mean, that's about time. I mean, you know, the Germans make a wonderful car. But if you really want something beautiful, have the Italians do it.
I've heard it said in a couple places that you're actually an introvert. Is that true?
Yeah, I am. I used to be so shy when I got out of the military and got my first office job that anybody in authority, I would have trouble even finishing a sentence around them. I mean, I was just petrified. And it was a hard time for me. And the way I got past that was I read about Charles Lindbergh, you know, the guy that did the first transatlantic flight. And he grew up on a farm, and he had no social skills. And the way he learned to do what he needed to do was he would identify certain people around him that he thought were good, and then he would try imitating them in small ways. I did that. Took me about 5 or 10 years, and then I was able to be who I am now. As far as being an introvert, I would just soon be home with my wife than anywhere. And so I don't like being places where there's a lot of people. Although I do go there, and I've learned to do public speaking and all that. But all of it took a big effort on my part. Yeah.
What's the hardest part of it, you think?
Well, the hardest part of doing all that is getting to the point where you don't judge yourself. And, you know, when you talk to your buddies or, you know, members of your family and you exchange back and forth, you don't judge yourself. You just are who you are. Well, learning to be who you are when you're in front of 500 or 700 people or doing an interview or being on television, that takes a point where it takes a while to get that faith in yourself. Now, I'm 68 years old. I mean, I didn't learn it when I was 17. And I'm finally starting to get it together. I'm thinking maybe by the time I'm 90, I'll really do a show.
I think that's probably one of the, I mean, I don't know. I'm only 38, but it's probably one of the most important lessons one can learn in their lifetime.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And, you know, Jerry Seinfeld does this little routine where he said, the number two fear people have is dying. The number one fear is public speaking. That means that if these people were at a funeral, they would rather be in the casket instead of delivering the eulogy.
That's fucked up. How do you want to die? I feel like you've thought about this.
How do I want to die? I don't know. I mean, however the Lord wants to take me, that's the way it'll be. I never thought about it. You know, I would probably like it to be, you know, as less painful as possible, but it is what it is. I mean, I really have no say-so over that. I mean, I've been through times when I thought I was going to die, period, and I didn't. I was a combat Marine in Vietnam. I was with the 1st Battalion, 26 Marines, north of Da Nang. And when I got there, I was one of the replacements for five casualties they had a few days earlier. Four were fatals. To a man, it was all the senior men. And so all the guys that were left were the greenest. The guy who was made the squad leader is a dear friend of mine to this day. He He was 19, been there like 6 weeks, and they made him squad leader, and he turned out to be brilliant. But I can remember thinking about, I thought a lot about dying back then, and I had what I think was an anxiety attack when I was alone thinking about what we were up against, and I accepted the fact that I'd die over there, and then it didn't bother me a bit. Then I just made two promises. The first promise was, is that I would do whatever I could to be a good Marine, so my folks back home would be proud of me. And second, that if at all possible, I'd be alive in mail call. And so they were the two things that got me through that totally.
You know, I think the idea that the life you're living, the decisions you've made for, in this case, what you're describing as being in the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
So those decisions are now putting you in a place where you're going to do something honorably that also might cause you to die. That is where else do you, don't get that anywhere else?
Well, no, not lately. So you're right. I mean, that is pretty much the military or anybody that's in law enforcement or, you know, firefighters or first responders or anybody of that ilk going into a situation knows what that's like. Or even somebody, a civilian that is part of something that gets hijacked or, you know, it's just life deals you that hand. And then you have to figure out how to think about it and how to react to it.
Now, obviously, for people listening to this podcast, not everybody has served in any capacity. But what can you say? At what point do you start learning a lesson by saying, what do you get? Why must you be okay with dying in order to do your job at that point?
Well, you know, I don't know that everybody is. I know that I was. You know, as long as you accept the result, and I've used this in my business career a number of times, and, you know, most of the stress in life is worried about what the result's going to be. Well, I've already accepted the worst result, and then I don't have any more stress over that. I kind of feel like I know what that's going to be, so I'll just do what I got to do each day to somehow make it better, to be a mail call. And there you go. And then sometimes it works out.
I don't understand that word. You said that word twice now. A mail call? Mail?
No, when they would you know, we would get snail mail letters.
A mail call.
Yeah.
Right. So if they stop.
I'm from Baltimore, Eric. You cut me a little slack, you know. I'm thrilled you can understand me.
I got every word but that. Mail call, basically, if you're not present for mail call, you're dead.
Well, that'd be dead or wounded, yeah. And so your letters wouldn't be there to hand to you.
Did you have any fun while you were in the Marines overseas? Was there any moment where you were like, this is actually fun? You know, with the way they depict it in the movies, it's kind of glamorized. Is it ever like that? Smoking cigarettes, like drinking, LSD?
You know, the interaction between you and your buddies sometimes is a lot of fun. It was always fun when we broke ambush in the morning.
What does that mean, broke ambush?
Well, we would go out on ambush at night and wait for North Vietnamese soldiers to come in and get this rice that we were guarding, and then, you know, we'd take care of that. But that war was fought at night. And when you break ambush is when you're done with the ambush and the sun is up, it's a brand new day, the war is over for a while, and you can kind of walk back to your base and, you know, who knows, might even be able to sit in a beer tent and have beer. I mean, you know, in Vietnam was the only time in my life where, and keep in mind, I was about 130 pounds, and I would drink a can of beer in the beer tent, one beer, I would be soaking wet and hammered.
Man, I mean, so did you guys listen to music and shit? Did he have concerts, or was that just all the movies?
No, we didn't have any concerts. Are you kidding?
Didn't do the USO or anything like that?
well, not out in the bush. You know, the guys in the rear area got to go to that, but the guys in the grunts or in the armies, 11 Bravo or 03s in the Marine Corps, you know, they didn't say, oh, there's a show, let's bring all these guys in, and no.
All right, so there's probably some people out there listening to this, some young men and women who want to have their own business or whatever. What are you going to say to them?
Well, here's what I say is, first of all, you can do it. Second, if you want to do something, find something you love and be engaged in your business for one reason, and that's to do the job right, and the rest will take care of itself. If you're in business and you want to go into it to make money, you'll make all the wrong decisions. And chances are you won't do the job right. So do what you love.
Is that true? So you didn't want to get rich?
Never.
That's impressive. I'm sorry you ended up rich. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, hey, you know, sometimes stuff works out, right?
Yeah. What... I ask a lot of people this at the end of the interview. Would you write a letter to golf for me really quick? Dear golf, whatever you want to say.
I would say it would be, dear golf, you know, I've been, I've been in love with you for 38 years. You're very frustrating, right? You're very fickle. But sometimes you just know how to make it happen. I love you, Bob.
All right. Thanks for your time, Bob. I appreciate it.